7% of the reporters agreed to the date is March 10th, 2016, and it doesn't have Vice Chair Senator Kiesel, Senate President Aaron Byer, Senator Stevens, and Senator Mitt Massaro. It's 1:31. The recording secretary is Terry, and our audio operator is Matt. Thank you for being so helpful to us to make this hearing possible. First, I'd like today's agenda is Senate Bill 168. This was introduced by Senator Breyer. We've had a hearing on it, and we've opened and closed public testimony. And first, I wanted to find out if members have any questions on the bill. This is the Barbers and Hairdressers Board composition. Any questions from committee members? Seeing none, Senator Kiesel.
In the Chair, I move on the Senate Bill 168, the Internal Laws 1385-04, coming with individual recommendations and instructions on the law.
Great, and thank you to Senator Barr's staff, Trevor Gutierrez, for being here. I appreciate it. Thank you. We'll take a brief break so we sign the paperwork.
We heard of Senator Kathy Kiesel, Senate District 10. Madam Chair, Nursing, Dentistry, Nursing. These two local provisions regulate their own practice. The regulations are written and updated to comply with changes in technology and education. Senate Bill 55 will modernize and update the U.S. optometry statute, aligning it with the optometrist's modern-based level of practice and allowing the Board of Optometry to regulate the profession just as other professions do. The current laws and statute defining the practice of optometry is 40 years old. This bill moves to continue education requirements starting in regulation overseen by the Board. The regulations already require 36 hours of continuing education, which is more than the 15 hours you see removed from this bill. Continuing education is still required. The hours and subjects will be determined by the Board of Optometry, just like other professional boards. Senate Bill 55 will also determine prescription drug schedules that could be used by optometrists, just as other boards do. It updates the definition of current education and training, but it specifically prohibits invasive surgery. I'm going to repeat that, Madam Chair, because it's going to be a topic today. This bill specifically prohibits invasive surgery. It defines that optometrists must be qualified for any procedure that they perform, just like other boards require of their healthcare professions. It defines and clarifies the prohibited surgical procedures under the definition of invasive surgery. I hear assertions today by opponents that this bill may allow optometrists to perform surgery on the eye, and that is simply not true. That board is specifically prohibited in this bill. Unless an optometrist already do superficial minor procedures such as the removal of corneal foreign bodies under current statute, but nothing invasive into the eye hole would be allowed. The vast majority of Alaskans visit one of the more than 150 Alaska optometrists for their eye care needs, vision tests, eyewear prescriptions, dual eye exams. But nationally, statistics show that 85% of Americans see an optometrist, a specialty provider in Alaska. In fact, in Alaska, we have optometrists located all over the state, and they travel to remote locations. There are 118 optometrists located in Anchorage, but there are 76 more optometrists scattered all over the state in 16 communities, ranging from Bethel to Nome to Clark or walk, and walk only. So, use the last mile for self. By contrast, there are approximately 20 ophthalmologists using the eye surgeons in Alaska. It's these 20 ophthalmologists who are opposing this bill. 195 optometrists are dissing in the state, all over the state. There's a significant drama around this bill. It reminds me of a lot of 1983, the drama surrounding nurse practitioners receiving independent practice through surgery. We were warning people would die. If you ask a state medical association and national affiliates, this is a very, very bad decision. But 33 years later, nobody's dying. Now, Armageddon. For example, the American Medical Association refused to recognize osteopathic physicians. Again, warning people would die if osteopaths were allowed to practice. Today, DOs, doctors of osteopathy, have this right next to medical doctors and nurse practitioners. And I seriously doubt that the average healthcare consumer knows the difference. Chiropractors, same scenario. Medical societies said people would die, but in fact, chiropractic therapy is a very effective pain management therapy without the use of opioids, and we know the dangers of opioids. So the list goes on. Credible, safe healthcare providers routinely oppose opposition groups. Safe, accessible, affordable health care was expanded when the legislature listened to the facts. So there's a lot of fear being expressed right now. One of the things you can look at, however, is malpractice insurance rates. If there's danger here, those insurance, malpractice insurance rates should reflect that. But in fact, you have in your supply of materials in summary of malpractice rates. And you'll find that optometrists are one of the lowest malpractice insurance rates in our nation. Because I look at them, they're pretty close to what I pay per year for my malpractice insurance as a malpractice inspector here. So Senate Bill 55 gives the optometry board the authority to oversee and regulate its own profession by regulation, allowing it to keep up with the latest changes without having to come to the legislature every time. We trust other boards to do the right thing. Medicine, nursing, dentistry, chiropractic examiners, physical therapists and occupational therapists, pharmacy, all of these regulate their own professions. The Board of Optometry needs to be included in this list. Madam Chair, Dan Connolly is here. My staff should be taking through a section of the wish, and I know there are many people who would like to disagree.
Thank you very much. If you would walk us through the section.
For the record, Jane Connolly, Senator Senator Kathy Diesel, many of these points of action have been outlined by Senator Diesel, and I will go section by section for clarity. Section 1 requires the optometry board to adopt regulations governing prescription and use of pharmaceutical agents. This updates the very old statute from the time before the optometry could adopt the drug guides. Section 2 amends 8272-1819 by removing specified hours and period of continuing education requirements. These are very outdated, the language in regulation now we have 34 hours, 36 hours of continuing education is required every 2 years, and it's far more than what we're talking about in the statute. Section 3 repeals and reenacts as 8272-217. This was restructured, the wording in the section was restructured by legal to reflect the current practice under optometry regulations. So that's why it was repealed and reimagined, because it was rewritten by legal services. Section 4 reenacts and modifies the prohibition by a licensee to perform an intravitreal injection, which means an injection into a jelly-like little part of the eye. Section 5 provides that a licensee may perform only services within the licensee's training and provide an experience as provided by board regulations, and it specifically prohibits invasive surgery. Section 6 revises the definition of optometry. The current definition is decades old, and it removes specific language as x-rays and scans, as those are procedures considered done every day in the practice of optometry. Section 7
Section 7 is the definition of invasive surgery, and that completes my section.
Thank you. What pharmacy will you need to allow optometrist seek to prescribe as of rights in this bill?
And what are they currently allowed to use?
Well, Madam Chair, as you had been in the past, antibiotics can be prescribed by an optometrist to treat that very simple and very common eye infection in children and adults. You may recall in 2014, Madam Chair, that the federal government changed the regulation of a controlled substance called Vicodin, hydrocodone, and moved it from Schedule 3, which was authorized for optometrists to prescribe, to Schedule 2. But I won't go into the details of what the schedules mean. It's but we had to come to the state legislature and get that authorized, get that final medication authorized. So that is the single Schedule 2 medication that they can prescribe. They can prescribe Schedule 3 opioids now. As well, but simple antibiotics, eye drops that might treat dry eye, for example, again, another common malady that folks are treating for.
And so that change has begun, especially in your bill, to allow the world just to get to regulate itself in that manner, or would that be separate?
The optometrists are currently able to do that in regulation. This would simply allow any updates to be regulated by the board. For example, the hydrocodone example. We had to come to the legislature to make that tweak. The board now in the future would be able to adjust the federal regulation changes much more nimbly.
And what is the current definition of optometry units in the section? And does this all change that?
It does not merge to the LLC.
Page 2, line 24. Jake Conway, Section 7, case on this. The description of optometry is optometry means the examination, evaluation, diagnosis, treatment, and performance of preventive procedures related to disease, disorder, or condition of the human eye or adjacent associated structures consistent with this chapter and regulations adopted by the board. And then how is it different then? Because this is a repeal and reenactment. Perhaps if you could tell us the difference in your same sentence here.
The definition is very similar, however, the new definition removed specific reference to x-rays and scans that optometry does every day, such as CT or CT scans, MRI scans, x-rays, blood tests, diagnosis and lasers for photography and examination, minor non-invasive surgery. So those things are taken out because those things are only being practiced.
And I see the word online 25 preventative procedures. Is that intentional in the language? Perhaps we can address that later.
We have several publishers who are online to speak to that. My expertise does not extend to that.
And then I have one final question before I move on to the committee members. Does this bill make Alaska unique in any way in terms of a comparison to other states? And I know that we, in the medical profession, we have challenges that are presented to us because of our remote communities. And so I know that that's something that we can have some of the new broken up in other areas of practice, but is this something that would make Alaska unique
to address the, I don't have a specific answer to the question, however, it's unique that other states actually allow more use of lasers and other techniques that still in Alaska we will be prohibiting.
Okay, thank you for that. Do other members of the committee have questions? Senator Stevens?
Maybe I'll tell you in the border itself, but COVID is not that border where their powers are. And specifically, is that just a border for optometrists and the oncologists is that medical board?
Senator Stevens, through the chair. So, ophthalmologists are physicians. They're actually eye surgeons, so they're regulated by the Board of Medicine. There is the Board of Optometry that is specific to optometrists, obviously. In fact, I'm looking here. This is not it. It is the last time sitting with the whole board. Now, you're wondering what the name of it is, so sorry, I didn't. Five persons on the board, four members shall be licensed practicing optometrists who have been residents for at least 3 years, one or more shall be a public member. That exists currently in the statute.
Senator Stevens,
through the chair, you may be speaking about LASIK surgery.
The better states allow more use of lasers, as I heard.
You are correct. That's what Jane referred to. Lasers are used in diagnostic procedures now. And so, it increases a laser. I'm not 100% sure what Jane was referring to. Perhaps some of the optometrists online could answer that for you. Laser technology is used more diagnostically. But if you're thinking of LASIK surgery, the board, just like any other regulatory board, only authorizes those things, those practices that education has been completed for. For example, my nursing board does not prohibit me from doing heart surgery. However, I'm not trained and educated in doing heart surgery, so I don't do it. If I did, clearly I would have some issues with my board. The same would apply here, just as any other medical profession. I'm a practice physician, so I don't do heart surgery or vascular surgery, despite the fact that physicians.
The
visitor's body, and perhaps the optometrist can explain this a bit for you. The visitor's body is the material in your actual eyeball that keeps your eye circular, okay, or whatever the shape is. In any case, it keeps it inflated, if you want to think of it that way. And so, procedures do entail sometimes injecting or entering that particular cavity. In this case, it would be prohibited for optometrists. The licensee may not perform an intravitreal injection. Exception. Exception to the sure. 272. chair understands the way that this section is modified is that it actually adds letter E, specifically calling out that a licensee may not perform an in vitro injection. So it just adds it into the statute. That's the change.
Thank you.
Okay, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Chair. So my questions have been asked and answered, but Senator Gisel, you had mentioned what the educational requirements are for ophthalmologists and medical school and pretty much the same as the doctor, I guess, and the doctors. What is the educational requirement for ophthalmologists?
It says right here, qualifications are essentially 72140, so you graduated the school or college of optometry recognized by the board. So it is a doctoral level training or education as well as residency option.
Four years of education for bachelor's degree, an additional 4 years in optometry school, and then an optional residency. And we might have some opportunities to maybe elaborate a little more on educational requirements.
Okay, so 8 years of college, basically. And then the ophthalmologist we have, we got about this, at least 8 years as well, correct?
Typically, you graduate 3 or 4 years of medical school and then a residency in a chosen specialty.
So, I think you mentioned that there would be non-basic surgery done, penetration to the globe, I guess, and I'm not much of a medical person. But that would not bring the federal from doing any work with the eyelid itself, not the eyeball of the globe, but the eyelid.
Similar with you, the chair. Currently, optometrists have the skill set to remove bishops, metal fragments from the cornea, debris from the eye, as well as treat maladies of the eyelid. Maybe you've got this guy before. They are qualified now to take care of those kinds of issues.
So does this building expand what we can do as far as the or is it the same?
It's in the last few years, it doesn't really sound like they can do all right.
Okay.
Thank you, Manager.
Thank you. I have a question before we went to Ms. Howie, who is the director of Proportions Business and Professional Licensing. You had mentioned that ophthalmologists are represented on the medical board, so they do not have their own separate board. Is that my understanding?
Madam Chair, the ophthalmologists are medical specialists. So the medical board regulates them. I don't know if there's an ophthalmologist currently as one of those board members. There certainly could be. The ophthalmologists don't have their own board.
And then you had provided us a list of the communities in Alaska that are served by optometrists. And I'm curious if the bill were passed, does it shift some of the work to those optometrists in those communities or perhaps a job there away from ophthalmologists in terms of the medical care that's being provided currently?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You see the list of optometrists right now in Alaska, and I talked about just the west, north, and south. In addition, optometrists travel rurally to provide local care in remote areas as well. I would point out, Madam Chair, that as of last year at least, the city of Juneau, where we currently are, has one ophthalmologist, that's the medical doctor surgeon specialty, so that if that individual were to go on vacation, there would be no one here to perform specialized surgery. We would be very much counting on our ophthalmologists to be available to assess and then refer the specialty care that we need on behalf of all of us who are on this panel.
Thank you. Any further questions or committee members? Thank you very much for presenting the bill. And then if other than could come forward just briefly,
7 years. And I'm here representing myself as well as the Alice Opioid Association. And I guess I'm ready to report your trial and I'll just say more about the program. The way you said Bill 55 is the legislation that was ready to correct our wrongs with word of opioid. The law is the statute that allows controls of regulation to be determined by the board. It is a correction act, as you have been issued with other provisions of law, too. There's no question that we, operating physicians, should be on the same our standard of care as other medical professionals. But it's absurd to suggest that we, as individuals, and as a profession, cannot regulate standards for their respective boards as others do. Over 27 years of practice, not just in this Medicare, so more than 50%, probably more than 70% of my patient business is not a medical nature. Routine diagnosis and managed complex cases that would have required referral a few years ago. Many of these cases require close working relationships with eye surgeons to routinely consult with our medical providers on a daily basis. Initials that use to require expensive travel to settle and break your own managed complex may effectively refer to travel or alcohol. A lot of the testing I perform in the office, and maybe it was various forms of information transfer to consent specialists, and I get referrals or pass the patients back, whether the patient had where I believe. Even though much of what we do now is not allowed, a few short years ago, city laws included the show and recognizing wrapping improvements and skills of training, both in our non-promoted positions and new graduates. You will hear this by Wolf. So that's kind of about patient harm that will occur once again if SB 55 is passed, or they know that the past 4 years of optometry scope expansion on SB 25 is the case. Optometry malpractice insurance rates are among the lowest of all providers for a reason. For people that don't like this bill, miss the point. They miss the point of why this bill is important. It's all about patients' best interest, and it's not about the doctors, me, or anybody else. A simple math from my body look at the broader field of ophthalmologists to serve a rapidly aging population. As skills and training expand, we need all eye care physicians to be able to practice their full level of training and expertise. As a former board member, I can tell you that nothing is more important than protecting the public. I don't see things changing at all in how I practice, and probably not in how other optometric physicians practice in the last year with the passage of this bill. They will provide, continue to provide quality care, protecting their patients' well-being as they live their own. I do foresee a streamlining of the legislative process to deal with pressing issues regarding the state of Alaska. The last time wasted debating what should be common sense. I'm talking to Mr. Longhorn, a high school professional who does the majority of first line of Medicare in Alaska. As our educational professional standards evolve, we should be able to practice the highest level of care consistent with our brand and education. Optometry has always been a cautious profession and will continue to be so into the future. I have no doubt the board is fully capable of providing oversight and maintaining standards needed to safeguard the public. SB 55 is a referral optometry that removes recurring burden for precious legislative time and most importantly, it's good for Alaskans. And I respectfully urge you to support Senate Bill 55.
Did you have any members questions for
the students? I appreciate the fact that you shared with the board for some time. Does this change the requirement for responsibility for the board as a bigger job now than it was before, or is it
I think it's a bigger job for your responsibility. It's not going to change the mindset of the board, though.
Well, optometry is considered an almost true fault. And me personally, as an optometrist, I'm considered an almost true fault. Well, in terms of the commitment to the other part of it, sounds like you're going to be a little bigger job than before.
I think it will be.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
John Alveson, also with the Alaska Optometrists Association.
I'm representing the Optometrists Association, and myself, and we've also been on the Board of Examiners of Optometry for two terms, one term as chair, several years ago. So, over my tenure here for over 24 years now as a practicing optometrist, and I've just had four different optometry bills over the years. It's simple from your face, and you know, every time we've had the same opposition, but we're not paying the public to that risk, and we are taking into account what we're asking you to do. Each time, the legislators have sifted through all the information and tested the information that we put forth to you, and then have passed bills to this where we are today. So Senate Bill 55 takes us to that next step. And gives us the board, the autonomy to run the optometrics profession in the state. So we just, ask them to continue putting their trust in us. Again, just reiterate that the, it's a safe profession. Again, our practice rates are under $500 a year, which is incredibly low. Some of the questions that are coming up is, would be new ground for Alaska optometrists to regulate themselves, but it's not new ground in that nurse practitioners, dentists can do the same thing. There are many states in my country that the optometry board can do what we're asking as far as regulating themselves. And several states where the scope of practice is broader than what we have here. So I really feel going to the protection of the public, I really feel that this bill does protect the public in that it keeps optometrists at the highest level of training. And so if we can go through that through the shorter regulatory process, that's going to make us be able to react a lot quicker if a new procedure or technique comes to fruition. There's still oversight. By the legislature in the form of making the legislators approve and appoint and approve the optometry board as well as the governor. So you still have that oversight as those who you want on that board in making those decisions in your behalf. The board members that I work with, the many board members over 30 years on the board, they were all very conscientious, intelligent, and they really understood the gravity of the decisions that they made. They understand optometry, they understand what we do every day on a daily basis.
I just would trust that they would never do anything or even allow optometrists to do anything without proper training, just as our track record has shown. So again, I hope you support Senate Bill 55, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Senator Stevens.
And I see you need after we be after we're practicing, but there's some different ways. We are required to be continuing education, which most of our 36 hours have to be in person. There are also we it's offered here at the state through our state association. This place varies throughout the meeting rooms every year. There are numerous optometry conferences. The continuing education is approved for those optometry conferences. Other areas would be in some of the schools of optometry to continue the education. I'm thinking about things that are on the list of approved CD. And so our continuing education is also accredited by our Council on Optometric Education. It has to be approved. So there's a level of regulation in what qualifies as continuing education. If it was many years ago when there was when we got approval to do injection training, there was a class offer here in the state to make sure everybody was up to speed on that if they had not already been trained on that in school.
Next, we will take someone from English, who's an LIO, Oliver Torsion.
Thank you. Thank you. rates, how were those rates affected after
raises are allowed in those four states?
Well, that I don't know, because at this point, a lot of these states are too early to have that kind of data, but that is definitely something that will be intriguing and we'll be watching that data as it comes through. But in general, you have to be trained within the labor and surgeries and so on. In general, that is something that you disclose. Or if the optometry school in your state builds a surgery center, for instance, to try to train their students, and that's the only way we'll see those prices go up. But there is never a doubt those prices will go up, and it would be impossible for them not to.
Senator Stephen? So, Dr. you are practicing eye surgery, right?
Yes, I am.
Can you tell us what you have for Speaker mentioned that you only also 5 years of the prescribed approach to our spaces that's on the right address. What would be your experience?
Well, in time, I prescribe prescriptions for quite a few specifically disease rare and generally to be a surgical patient. So someone who may be post-injury repair, in other words, they had a rupture to their eye, or they had open fractures that had to be repaired. But kind of routine, normal eye condition, an optometrist, or their radiologist, or myself, that it is very rare that it comes up to prescribe prescription for eye.
Thank you very much. Next, we will take Jeff Gonison with the Alaska Optometry Association. And I did want to say for those two individuals who are also on the public testimony, Mr. Gonison will be the final testifier today, and we'll keep the public testimony open for our next meeting. So with that, Mr. Gonison.
Thank you very much. My name is Jeff Gonison, OD. I represent as the legislative chair of the Alaska Optometric Association, and myself. I was the first Alaska Native Optometrist licensed in Alaska for 39 years, and I served as a member of the State Bureau of Optometry twice under two different governors. So I'd like to give you a little history for those of you who are new to the issue. The four primary professions of medicine, nursing, optometry, and advanced practice nurses are all independent, all on their own boards, who are all currently authorized by state law to treat diseases and prescribe drugs including controlled substances, or TDA numbers. Optometry's professional doctor's degree was brought up to the same level as medicine and dentistry around 1969, a four-year graduate school program with available residencies for advanced training. About its 1988, Alaska became the 50th and last U.S. legislature to allow us to even use diluting the anesthetic eye drops. In 1992, Alaska became the 37th state to authorize optometrists to prescribe topical medications. And in 2007, the legislature added oral and injectable medications, including the narcotics. So the doctors talking about narcotics have been doing those for over 9 years already. And optometrists have been defined as physicians under federal Medicare for many years. Well, optometrists practice all over the state, as you know, provide the best of your eye care in Alaska. Local optometrists are often called upon at rural hospitals for their expertise. But most interestingly, every time optometry has come to any state, legislature or past board years, the Ophthalmologist National Academy has heard from and politically organized entities to testify that optometrists would be killed in their blinding people that were going to go to medical school, and there's no go to medical school. But these bills are a medical emergency, et cetera, et cetera, goes on and on, and none of these ridiculous claims are true. Our border country is a back in the historical record, but is English. So the point is, in the Bill 55, there's not authorized optometrists to do anything. There's nothing to do with the optometrists, any authority to do all these invasive surgeries they talk about. What it does, it updates the old statutes, it gives the state board their autonomy to regulate the same as the dentist and the advanced practice nurses do. The board would never authorize autonomous or anything they're not trained and qualified to do. and it occurred by the Section 5 of the bill. We already discussed the drug. There's nothing we're changing for this. In the current law, it states that we are limited to a 4-day supply. And I promise you that that word from the board will put that in a regulation. There'll still be a limit on 4-day supply. We're not trying to open up anything. We like having just a 4-day supply. No one comes to us for drugs. We are not any part of the drug problem in the country. That is very, very liberal. My final point is that family MPs are not restricted from performing any surgery, the brain surgery, but they do not. Why? Because they use the professional judgment to know when to refer to specialists. So, for the same example, we have topics of a family high doctors, and we know when to treat patients and when to refer to specialists. You don't hear the heart surgeons that I'm not thinking about to fight against competitive practice doctors, do you? Well, again, everyone knows where that specialty is and what they can do. Optometry is a valued member of the Alaska Healthcare Team, so please support the board for the advisory vote for Senate Bill 55. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much, and I do want to extend a note to those three individuals for having waiting post 6:30. We did call up in the recent public testimony today, but then at 2:30, because we do have a bill that's just going to be introduced. I'd like to let you know that we will continue the public testimony, and my name is Weston Eiler, and he's at 465-4968. If you have any questions about when that will be, we'll most likely be at our meeting on Tuesday. So I want to say thank you to those individuals, and thank you to the bill sponsor for introducing Senate Bill 55. Next, we will have an introduction of Senate Bill 197. And if the bill sponsor, Sarah, could come forward. The intention today is just to have the bill presented to us. And I would like to welcome Lee Moss, the Senator of John Coffey's office, and Kevin Fish, the intern for Senator Coffey's office. And please feel free to introduce the bill for the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Lee Moss, Senator of Senator Coffey, and I represent Kevin Fish, who is our intern from the University of Alaska in Anchorage this year. He will be carrying the bill, and we also have someone online as a lifeline, Dan Toth. So between Dan and I, we will try to give as much support to Congress as we can. Madam Chair, this bill is about protecting the customers and the dealers in order to protect the business, the car dealership business. And the car dealership business in Alaska is unique because there is a limited amount of folks that are participating in this business. There's only 29 dealerships in the state, which compared to Wyoming with 580,000 population in the 580,000 has 52 dealerships in this state. So there's not a lot of people participating in this business. So that affects how much you'll be able to, look for people that they can restructure their agreements and other such features. The dealers are especially dependent on manufacturers are for because the dealers invest so much money just to franchise and become economically captive to the manufacturer. The dealer puts in a substantial risk which allows the manufacturer to be able to pressure them in certain ways and essentially makes them capture the kind of business that we have to choose when they're able to get the merchandise and need to get merchandise. This legislation is being introduced to more fairly adjust that ratio so that dealers get a fair deal, the customers get a fair deal, and the manufacturers aren't out of the loop. facilities, and that they even have special circumstances for a new officer. So that's a geological circumstance for a new officer. And this bill, of course, the provisions are unique, but dealing with to certain areas in TOC or known and provisions with that contract went out in order to have the work done and needs to be done without making a burden on the customers. This also deals with U.S. Section Data Determination and dealer needs of quality work. And the best way to describe the determination is by adding a good cause determination in order for it to be a more fair and equal way to determine what will happen in the future. And in order to define termination of the contract in the different agreements, there's a bunch of different things that this bill is trying to accomplish. It's trying to make a more fair practice for the dealer in making a new system in which they were paid. And it's trying to get them 100% compensation for what they do. Manufacturing work is trying to make it so that the manufacturers have to prove that they are actually there's an actual need for the dealership in order to put one there instead of having and it's trying to make sure that manufacturers have a more easy like it's trying to make sure basically so the manufacturers do not take over the company, there's restrictions. And there's restrictions in a certain way that allows that the dealers can, so that they can replace another dealer in there if it's necessary. So if the dealer's goods and it is not good or is bankrupt or something happens, then the manufacturer can take over the company for a period of 2 years and then we'll be able to try and find someone else that will take over the company. This legislation is not trying to be one-sided at all. It's trying to find a fair, equal, fair, equal decision between the two entities, the manufacturer and the dealer, while including the needs of the licensor and by updating the statute that is currently the contract statute is now and compare it to
Washington. It is also recognizing the fact that the Boston has some unique geographic issues with working and recall work. For instance, a person in Hula or Nome, where there is no car dealer, would have to, at a great expense, transport their car to Fairbanks or to Juneau. It's very time consuming. The person's in that vehicle. This bill would actually allow dealer to contract with someone in the community where the car is located to do recall and warranty work. So it is a matter of both. It is also a matter of the industry itself changing considerably in the last 14 years since the last enactment of car dealership statutes in 2002, which Representative Murkowski and Representative Pelgrim mentioned. A lot of difference in techniques and what makes all the bill run. these dealers are required to obtain specialty tools that can cost over $50,000 to do diagnostic work. Back in 2002, signs were leased by dealers. Now they have to invest $100,000 for a sign. And this bill would give them some protection if there was a termination, that they would be reimbursed for their investments. I believe signs would be reimbursed at assessed value, a fair market value, going back 2 years. So if you buy a sign 2 years ago, and there was a termination, then they could be reimbursed for that. It also makes provisions for reimbursement for leases that would have to be canceled if their citizenship was terminated. It's a pretty intense bill. It's a very long bill. And to assist you in studying the bill, we've prepared a very lengthy section of it in layman's terms. We've also provided you with some of the data we'd like to see when you're repealing statutes. I'd like to know what language is that you're repealing. We've also repealed and reenacted several sections of law, and we have given you the old language so that you can compare it to what the new language is. And we've also included some definitions that are assigned by the statute, so you can really tell what the definitions are.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. Usually, in the committee, we actually do both go through the section when we have a lot of time for that, but before we go through the section, I have a question. So, how are these agreements, how is the relationship currently established between the dealers and the manufacturers?
I'm sure they are franchise agreements, and they are not agreements that are renewed in a common sequence. Some of these franchise agreements are 30 years old, some of them might be 5 years old. They have been amended, maybe once or twice, or maybe several times. So this is a pattern to take those existing agreements and make some changes in how the manufacturer has to treat the franchise.
So, if you'd like to go through the, unless there's other questions from the committee members, I'll go through the section. Senator Blair?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my first question is it a requirement in working in Senator Conkle's office that you learn from this?
Your knowledge, sir? Senator Blair?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm very happy. So, the next question I have is if we pass this bill as is, and we're looking at safe harm analysis in more detail, and perhaps I should leave, but if somebody has a 20-year agreement or contract, would this become retroactive into the day one if we?
Yes, I'm pretty sure Senator Meyer and Section 2 has a capability.
All right, that's a little concerning to me. Madam Chair, maybe you'll retroactive that.
Madam Chair, if I address the question from Senator Romero, if you see the applicability clause, it does say that any provision in this is not by the Constitution of the United States or of Alaska. So if there's a Constitution,
please.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
It is page 2, line 2. And then Section 1, Madam Chair, is just legislative findings that state that the investments need to be protected, and we need to maintain a healthy dealership industry in Alaska and provide consumer protection for Alaskans and provide okay grant jobs. So on Section 3, on page 2, line 10, the section amends language requiring a manufacturer that are good products to terminate a franchise agreement to include provisions of 115, which is a new section,
that clearly lays out what the cause is. But if the notification requirements allows for proactive actions on the part of the dealer and sets guidelines for both the manufacturer and the dealer. Section 4 is on page 2, line 3, and it creates good causes. Good cause exists if the dealer fails to comply with the franchise agreement that is reasonable and materially significant. If good cause if the manufacturer notices the dealer of a failure in the agreement and the dealer does not take corrective action. If the failure of performance in sales and services or level of customer satisfaction, it must be a standard that is applied uniformly to all new car dealers. If the manufacturer does not provide adequate supply of quality, quantity, and product mix, the franchise agreement cannot be terminated. The cause to terminate, and this is in existing law, with one exception, and I'll point that out, is insolvency, bankruptcy, and receivership, failure to open for business for 7 consecutive days, principal operators convicted of a felony, and this is a new provision that the dealer has had a license revoked or suspended for more than 30 days. In Alaska, a new vehicle dealer has to have both a business license, which is $100 every 2 years, and a license from DMV, which requires a $50 fee over 2 years and a $50,000 surety bond. Another good cause is unfair practices.
So it's supposed to fall in a different section?
No, I'm still in section 4.
Okay.
Unfair practices by the manufacturer are not good causes for termination. Part of the terms of good cause, there are going to be some unfair practices later in the news bill that would maybe be a good cause for a manufacturer to terminate the contract. So if the contractor is trying to terminate a contract on the basis of good cause, but it is a practice that is listed as an unfair practice, it would not be a good cause to terminate the contract. Very sure.
I understand the good cause
that makes sense for termination that I could fit in all of it. But doesn't that apply to every franchise company or site members or requirement that's just for automobiles? It seems to be out of some paper, maybe a dictionary or something like that.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, we actually, about 5 years ago, passed some legislation that deals with recreational vehicles. And it is the nature of the industry that causes this. And the amount of investment that businesses have to put into franchises.
Okay, thank you.
And then the other part of the cause is on the manufacturer. The next section is section 5, which is on page 5. And it simply adds to existing language, the existing statute, the provision that before termination of a franchise agreement, the notice for a 15-day notice of termination adds a provision for a dealer who has had their license revoked for 30 days or more. Section 6 is termination by the dealer. It's on page 6. It requires that a dealer may terminate a franchise agreement by notifying the manufacturer at least 90 days before termination. Section 7 is on page 6, line 8. It's a fairly lengthy section that deals with inventory equipment and other equipment. When a franchise is terminated, this section outlines in detail how the dealer will recover the cost of the investment in vehicles, equipment, parts, supplies, signage, office equipment, and special tools that were required by the manufacturer
less than certain credits against that inventory. Vehicles are reimbursed at the dealer's cost for 2 long years at the end of 30, plus charges for distribution, delivery, and taxes, and less allowances by the manufacturer for total damage to the vehicle, and 20 cents per mile for all mileage on a vehicle over 200 miles. All of some supplies, parts, and accessories in original unbroken packages that are listed in manufacturer's current catalog and those supplies, parts, and accessories that the manufacturer required the dealer to buy will be reimbursed at the dealer's cost. And again, this is if the franchise is terminated. For each undamaged sign that bears a common name, trade name, or trademark, the manufacturer recommended or required signs will be reimbursed at fair market value. All equipment, furnishings, and special tools owned by the dealer because the manufacturer recommended or required the purchase will be reimbursed at fair market value. The items from the lease of the manufacturer will reimburse the dealer the amount necessary to terminate the lease rate. The same is basically true of all computer, software, and printers required by the manufacturer or reasonably necessary to operate the dealership to the manufacturer's standards. If the franchise agreement requires the manufacturer to pay the dealer an amount higher, it's stipulated in the statute, the permission of the franchise agreement will prevail. The dealer will return all the items within 90 days, and the actual manufacturer will pay the dealer 30 days after the delivery of the items. Section 8 is on page 8, line 13. That's the payment for dealership facilities and business. As I said before, dealers made a significant investment in the dealer locations. Manufacturers require renovations, and some of these renovations include hundreds of thousands of dollars. One example was the dealership here in Seattle was required by Toyota to replace all the floor tile in a certain floor there. This says that if the dealership is terminated, and the manufacturer would have to reimburse the franchise dealer for that expense because it was something that the manufacturer required as part of the franchise. If the facility is owned by the dealer, the manufacturer would pay a reasonable rent for the facility for 24 months or until the facility is leased or sold. If the facility was leased, then the manufacturer would reimburse the dealer for the amount that it would take to terminate the lease rent for the facility. In other words, if there was 6 months left on the lease, the manufacturer would be responsible for reimbursing the dealer for that 6 months because he would have to pay that 6 months. Section 9 is on page 9, line 9. This says that reimbursement for vehicles, equipment, supplies, parts, furnishings, computers, etc. is not required if a dealer is insolvent, subject to bankruptcy or receivership proceedings, is failed to conduct its customary operations for 7 consecutive days, is convicted of a felony, or is had a license revoked for more than 30 days, or if the dealer voluntarily agrees to sell the franchise and the manufacturer hasn't approved the agreement. In other words, if the termination was because of the cause, then the manufacturer would not have to reimburse the dealer. Section 10 is on page 10, line 2. This section defines what a qualified buyer is. A
qualified by our state normal racing rule and uniform the applied standards established by the manufacturer, or already holds a franchise from the manufacturer, or is capable of being licensed as a new motor vehicle dealer in Alaska. A qualified buyer must promptly provide financial and personal information to the manufacturer and agree to be bound by all reasonable terms and conditions of the franchise. If the manufacturer refuses to approve the qualified buyer, you must give written notice to the dealer. And the dealer must receive a certified return receipt notice that the manufacturer has denied the transfer. Section 11 is on page 11, line 4. This section clarifies that the dealer has an obligation to justify any damages that he claims upon termination. Section 12 is on page 11, line 8. As I said before, dealers make a huge investment in their business, and as with any major investment, they want to pass on this investment to their family or other successors. This section lays out the process for assigning succession for a dealership agreement. The owner of the franchise has two methods of operating of appointing a successor, but any time the dealer can appoint to designate the successor to succeed ownership of the franchise to someone upon the owner's death or incapacity by giving written notice to the manufacturer. Or, if the dealer has owned the franchise, he or she may designate someone, and if they have owned it for 5 years, I should say, he or she may designate someone to succeed ownership at a certain time, at a certain date, before the dealer's death or incapacity, by giving the manufacturer written notice. And the manufacturer has the option of refusing that too, with a burden of proof. Lays on the manufacturer. Section 13 is on page 13, line 6. This deals with new or relocated dealerships. Before a manufacturer can establish or relocate a dealership within a dealer's relevant market area, the manufacturer must give the existing dealer 90 days notice, and he must also give the dealer the option of purchasing a dealership. Before the manufacturer can create a new dealership, the manufacturer must show good cause for an action considering the existing circumstances, and there's a whole list of criteria that the dealership or that the manufacturer must look at, including growth in the employment population, on a 5-year term, effect on the consumer public, effect on existing dealers, and whether the existing dealer is substantially and significantly violating a franchise agreement. Section 14 is court badges. And this is a subsection that Senator Stevens had asked about existing law. I had legal looking at this because it's quite possible that existing law already covers this.
So, as we have about 5 minutes left, I'm just curious, just so you can either determine whether we can get through the bill, and if not, that's fine. I just wanted to let you know.
Sure.
How are we going
to do? I think I'll go to section 16, which is page 21, line 28. This is the amendment question that Senator Stevens had about unfair practices. And this is a whole list of unfair practices that should the manufacturer do, it would not be cause for termination of the contract for the year, such as sell vehicles or parts to one dealer at a lower price and sold to another, using marketing plans with one dealer and not another, adopting unreasonable, unfair, unequitable methods for allocation, refusing to deliver in reasonable quantities and reasonable time products to the dealer, and requiring the dealer to remodel or renovate existing facilities as a prerequisite for receiving loans or series of loans or vehicles, failure to offer the dealer all models manufactured for the line make of the vehicles. Another one is if the manufacturer tries to terminate a dealership because it either owned or operated a dealership that was a dealership other than the line length of the franchise agreement. In other words, a good example is Juno, because Juno has a dealership that has Toyota, Chevy, Subaru, three or four lines of vehicles. But owners who attempt the dealer to refrain from or prohibit them from acquiring another reline very similar, prevent a dealer from changing executive management deals to manager to improve the change will result in management by a person who does not have good moral character or who does not meet reasonable pre existing standards that are used by the manufacturer for all years. Require dealers in addition of branding or renewal and franchise to waive, limit, or disclaim the right to protest the establishment or relocation of another dealer in a relevant area. Increase the price of a vehicle from which there exists a purchaser at the time of the order, and the order was made before a manufacturer provided the dealer with a written price and price notification. And then Section 17 is the definition. Section 18 are three definitions. Section 19 is a repeal, and I am giving you the language that has been repealed on the top of this one here. And then Section 20 addresses the rate that is paid to a dealer for repairs, warranty, and recall repairs. It is a formula that is prepared as well as schedule of compensation. And the way I understand it is they take, within a 180-day period, they take 50 invoices for different services or invoices for 45 days, whichever is closer. And that's because of the market size of Alaska. They have all those up and do it every time. And that determines what rate is paid to the dealer for the manufacturer to resolve the work. And I think that covers it all.
Thank you. Your timing is impressive. So I want to thank the staff of the Bill Sponsor Center, the local staff, for introducing the bill to the committee. And we did not manage public testimony today. We have a plan all along to just get the first glance at this legislation. And so with that, I want to mention that our next meeting is Tuesday, March 15th. And that is the decision.